Chapter 17. Take it as well, and this was, that notwithstanding these English subjects of mine, as he called them, had lived with these women almost 7 years, had taught them to speak English, and even to read it, and that they were, as he perceived, women of tolerable understanding, and capable of instruction, yet they had not, to this hour, taught them anything of the Christian religion, no, not so much, as to know there was a God, or a worship, or in what manner God was to be served, or that their own idolatry, and worshipping they knew not whom, was false and absurd. This, he said, was an unaccountable neglect, and what God would certainly call them to account for, and perhaps at last take the work out of their hands. He spoke this very affectionately and warmly. I am persuaded, says he, had those men lived in the savage country whence their wives came, the savages would have taken more pains to have brought them to be idolaters, and to worship the devil, than any of these men, so far as I can see, have taken with them to teach the knowledge of the true God. Now, sir, said he, though I do not acknowledge your religion, or you mine, yet we would be glad to see the devil's servants, and the subjects of his kingdom taught to know religion, and that they might, at least, hear of God and a Redeemer, and the resurrection, and of a future state things which we all believe, that they might, at least, be so much nearer coming into the bosom of the true church than they are now in the public profession of idolatry and devil worship. I could hold no longer. I took him in my arms, and embraced him eagerly. How far, said I to him, have I been from understanding the most essential part of a Christian, viz., to love the interest of the Christian church, and the good of other men's souls? I scarce have known what belongs to the being a Christian. Oh, sir, do not say so, replied he, this thing is not your fault. No, said I, but why did I never lay it to heart as well as you? It is not too late yet, said he. Be not too forward to condemn yourself. But what can be done now? Said I. You see I am going away. Will you give me leave to talk with these poor men about it? Yes, with all my heart, said I. And oblige them to give heed to what you say to. As to that, said he, we must leave them to the mercy of Christ. But it is your business to assist them, encourage them, and instruct them. And if you give me leave, and God is blessing, I do not doubt, but the poor ignorant souls shall be brought home to the great circle of Christianity, if not into the particular faith we all embrace, and that even while you stay here. Upon this I said, I shall not only give you leave, but give you 1,000 thanks for it. I now pressed him for the third article in which we were to blame. Why, really, says he, it is of the same nature. It is about your poor savages, who are, as I may say, your conquered subjects. It is a maxim, sir, that is or ought to be received among all Christians, of what church or pretended church soever, that the Christian knowledge ought to be propagated by all possible means, and on all possible occasions. It is on this principle that our church sends missionaries into Persia, India, and China, and that our clergy, even of the superior sort, willingly engage in the most hazardous voyages, and the most dangerous residence amongst murderers and barbarians, to teach them the knowledge of the true God, and to bring them over to embrace the Christian faith. Now, sir, you have such an opportunity here to have 36 poor savages brought over from a state of idolatry to the knowledge of God, their Maker and Redeemer, that I wonder how you can pass such an occasion of doing good, which is really worth the expense of a man's whole life. I was now struck dumb indeed, and had not one word to say. I had here the spirit of true Christian zeal for God and religion before me. As for me, I had not so much as entertained a thought of this in my heart before, and I believe I should not have thought of it, for I looked upon these savages as slaves, and people whom, had we not had any work for them to do, we would have used as such, or would have been glad to have transported them to any part of the world, for our business was to get rid of them, and we would all have been satisfied, If they had been sent to any country, so they had never seen their own. I was confounded at his discourse, and knew not what answer to make him. He looked earnestly at me, seeing my confusion. "Sir," says he, "I shall be very sorry, if what I have said gives you any offense." "No, no," said I am offended with nobody but myself, but I am perfectly confounded, not only to think that I should never take any notice of this before, but with reflecting what notice I am able to take of it now. "You know, sir," said I, "what circumstances I am in. I am bound to the East Indies in a ship freighted by merchants, and to whom it would be an insufferable piece of injustice to detain their ship here, the men lying all this, while at victuals and wages on the owner's account. It is true, I agreed to be allowed 12 days here, and if I stay more, I must pay £3 sterling per diem demurrage. Nor can I stay upon demurrage above 8 days more, and I have been here 13 already, so that I am perfectly unable to engage in this work, unless I would suffer myself to be left behind here again. In which case, if this single ship should miscarry in any part of her voyage, I should be just in the same condition that I was left in here at first, and from which I have been so wonderfully delivered." He owned the case was very hard upon me, as to my voyage, but laid it home upon my conscience, whether the blessing of saving 37 souls was not worth venturing all I had in the world for. I was not so sensible of that as he was. I replied to him thus: "Why, sir, it is a valuable thing, indeed, to be an instrument in God's hand to convert 37 heathens to the knowledge of Christ. But as you are an ecclesiastic, and are given over to the work, so it seems so naturally to fall in the way of your profession. How is it, then, that you do not rather offer yourself to undertake it than to press me to do it?" Upon this he faced about just before me, as he walked along, and putting me to a full stop, made me a very low bow. "I most heartily thank God and you, sir," said he, "for giving me so evident a call to so blessed a work, and if you think yourself discharged from it, and desire me to undertake it, I will most readily do it, and think it a happy reward for all the hazards and difficulties of such a broken, disappointed voyage as I have met with, that I am dropped at last into so glorious a work." I discovered a kind of rapture in his face, while he spoke this to me. His eyes sparkled like fire, his face glowed, and his color came and went. In a word, he was fired with the joy of being embarked in such a work. I paused a considerable while, before I could tell what to say to him, for I was really surprised to find a man of such sincerity, and who seemed possessed of a zeal beyond the ordinary rate of men. But after I had considered it a while, I asked him seriously if he was in earnest, and that he would venture, on the single consideration of an attempt to convert those poor people, to be locked up in an unplanted island for perhaps his life, and at last might not know whether he should be able to do them good or not. He turned short upon me, and asked me what I called a venture. "Pray, sir," said he, "what do you think I consented to go in your ship to the East Indies for?" "Eh," said I, "that I know not, unless it was to preach to the Indians." "Doubtless it was," said he, "and do you think, if I can convert these 37 men to the faith of Jesus Christ, it is not worth my time, though I should never be fetched off the island again? Nay, is it not infinitely of more worth to save so many souls than my life is, or the life of 20 more of the same profession?" "Yes, sir," says he, "I would give God thanks all my days, if I could be made the happy instrument of saving the souls of those poor men, though I were never to get my foot off this island, or see my native country any more. But since you will honor me with putting me into this work, for which I will pray for you all the days of my life, I have one humble petition to you besides." "What is that?" said one. "Why," says he, "it is, that you will leave your man Friday with me, to be my interpreter to them, and to assist me, for without some help I cannot speak to them, or they to me. I was sensibly touched at his requesting Friday, because I could not think of parting with him, and that for many reasons. He had been the companion of my travels. He was not only faithful to me, but sincerely affectionate to the last degree, and I had resolved to do something considerable for him, if he outlived me, as it was probable he would. Then I knew that, as I had bred Friday up to be a Protestant, it would quite confound him to bring him to embrace another religion, and he would never, while his eyes were open, believe that his old master was a heretic, and would be damned, and this might in the end ruin the poor fellow's principles, and so turn him back again to his first idolatry. However, a sudden thought relieved me in this strait, and it was this. I told him I could not say that I was willing to part with Friday on any account whatever, though a work that to him was of more value than his life ought to be of much more value than the keeping or parting with a servant. On the other hand, I was persuaded that Friday would by no means agree to part with me, and I could not force him to it without his consent, without manifest injustice. Because I had promised I would never send him away, and he had promised and engaged that he would never leave me unless I sent him away. He seemed very much concerned at it, for he had no rational access to these poor people, seeing he did not understand one word of their language, nor they one of his. To remove this difficulty, I told him Friday's father had learned Spanish, which I found he also understood, and he should serve him as an interpreter. So he was much better satisfied, and nothing could persuade him, but he would stay, and endeavor to convert them. But Providence gave another very happy turn to all this. I come back now to the first part of his objections. When we came to the Englishmen, I sent for them all together, and after some account given them, of what I had done for them, viz., what necessary things I had provided for them, and how they were distributed, which they were very sensible of, and very thankful for, I began to talk to them of the scandalous life they led, and gave them a full account of the notice the clergyman had taken of it. And arguing how unchristian and irreligious a life it was, I first asked them if they were married men or bachelors. They soon explained their condition to me, and showed that two of them were widowers, and the other three were single men, or bachelors. I asked them with what conscience they could take these women, and call them their wives, and have so many children by them, and not be lawfully married to them? They all gave me the answer I expected, viz., that there was nobody to marry them, that they agreed before the governor to keep them as their wives, and to maintain them, and own them as their wives, and they thought, as things stood with them, they were as legally married as if they had been married by a parson, and with all the formalities in the world. I told them that no doubt they were married in the sight of God, and were bound in conscience to keep them as their wives, but that the laws of men being otherwise, they might desert the poor women and children hereafter, and that their wives, being poor desolate women, friendless and moneyless, would have no way to help themselves. I therefore told them that, unless I was assured of their honest intent, I could do nothing for them, but would take care that what I did should be for the women and children without them, and that, unless they would give me some assurances that they would marry the women, I could not think it was convenient they should continue together as man and wife, for that it was both scandalous to men and offensive to God, who they could not think would bless them if they went on thus. All this went on as I expected, and they told me, especially Will Atkins, who now seemed to speak for the rest, that they loved their wives as well as if they had been born in their own native country, and would not leave them on any account whatever, and they did verily believe that their wives were as virtuous and as modest, and did, to the utmost of their skill, as much for them, and for their children, as any woman could possibly do, and they would not part with them on any account. Will Atkins, for his own particular, added that if any man would take him away, and offer to carry him home to England, and make him captain of the best man of war in the navy, he would not go with him, if he might not carry his wife and children with him. And if there was a clergyman in the ship, he would be married to her now with all his heart. This was just as I would have it. The priest was not with me at that moment, but he was not far off. So to try him further, I told him I had a clergyman with me, and, if he was sincere, I would have him married next morning, and bade him consider of it, and talk with the rest. He said, as for himself, he need not consider of it at all, for he was very ready to do it, and was glad I had a minister with me, and he believed they would be all willing also. I then told him that my friend, the minister, was a Frenchman, and could not speak English, but I would act the clerk between them. He never so much as asked me whether he was a Papist or Protestant, which was, indeed, what I was afraid of. We then parted, and I went back to my clergyman, and Will Atkins went in to talk with his companions. I desired the French gentleman not to say anything to them till the business was thoroughly ripe, and I told him what answer the men had given me. Before I went from their quarter, they all came to me and told me they had been considering what I had said, that they were glad to hear I had a clergyman in my company, and they were very willing to give me the satisfaction I desired, and to be formally married as soon as I pleased, for they were far from desiring to part with their wives, and that they meant nothing but what was very honest when they chose them. So I appointed them to meet me the next morning, and, in the meantime, they should let their wives know the meaning of the marriage law, and that it was not only to prevent any scandal, but also to oblige them, that they should not forsake them, whatever might happen. The women were easily made sensible of the meaning of the thing, and were very well satisfied with it, as, indeed, they had reason to be. So they failed not to attend all together at my apartment next morning, where I brought out my clergyman. And though he had not on a minister's gown, after the manner of England, or the habit of a priest, after the manner of France, yet having a black vest something like a cassock, with a sash round it, he did not look very unlike a minister. And as for his language, I was his interpreter. But the seriousness of his behavior to them, and the scruples he made of marrying the women, because they were not baptized and professed Christians, gave them an exceeding reverence for his person, and there was no need, after that, to inquire whether he was a clergyman or not. Indeed, I was afraid his scruples would have been carried so far as that he would not have married them at all. Nay, notwithstanding all I was able to say to him, he resisted me, though modestly, yet very steadily, and at last refused absolutely to marry them, unless he had first talked with the men and the women too. And though at first I was a little backward to it, yet at last I agreed to it with a good will, perceiving the sincerity of his design. When he came to them, he let them know that I had acquainted him with their circumstances, and with the present design, that he was very willing to perform that part of his function, and marry them, as I had desired, but that before he could do it, he must take the liberty to talk with them. He told them that in the sight of all indifferent men, and in the sense of the laws of society, they had lived all this while in a state of sin, and that it was true that nothing but the consenting to marry, or effectually separating them from one another, could now put an end to it. But there was a difficulty in it too, with respect to the laws of Christian matrimony, which he was not fully satisfied about, that of marrying one, that is a professed Christian, to a savage, an idolater, and a heathen one, that is not baptized. And yet that he did not see that there was time left to endeavor to persuade the women to be baptized, or to profess the name of Christ, whom they had, he doubted, heard nothing of, and without which they could not be baptized. He told them he doubted they were but indifferent Christians themselves, that they had but little knowledge of God, or of his ways, and, therefore, he could not expect that they had said much to their wives on that head yet, but that unless they would promise him to use their endeavors with their wives to persuade them to become Christians, and would, as well as they could, instruct them in the knowledge and belief of God that made them, and to worship Jesus Christ that redeemed them, he could not marry them, for he would have no hand in joining Christians with savages, nor was it consistent with the principles of the Christian religion, and was, indeed, expressly forbidden in God's law. They heard all this very attentively, and I delivered it very. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.